refining for human values, for what it is, what it means to be human. If you keep your head down, you will not only lose your job, you will lose your livelihood, you will lose your social life, you will lose your dignity, you will lose everything that makes life worth living.
COVID-19 restrictions have weighed heavy on populations around the world. Many people are searching for inspiration and encouragement during a time where there is a lack of clarity and guidance. But this crisis has shown that there are natural-born leaders who, during a time of hardship, step up and take initiative. Willem Engel is the spokesperson for the Netherlands-based group Virus Truth, or Virus Waarheid. The dance instructor and scientist turned activist is taking on the Dutch government in big ways, whether that be challenging the curfew or attempting to put an end to police brutality. Willem Engel has become the face of the resistance in Europe. His organization, Virus Truth, seeks to educate, inform, and hold those in positions of power accountable for what the organization believes are crimes against humanity. And while this work comes with a heavy price to pay, Willem has a message of unity, love, and truth that is nothing short of inspiring. I'm independent journalist Taylor Hudak, and joining us today to share with us his story of activism and fight for freedom and human rights during the age of COVID-19 is Dutch activist and dancer Willem Engel. Willem, I want to thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. So why don't we get started with you telling us just a little bit about yourself and what inspired you to take initiative against lockdowns and other restrictions?
Yes. Well, at the moment I have a dance school, but before I was a scientist. I studied pharmaceutical sciences, and then I did a PhD in applied nanotechnology, trying to couple nanofluidic devices to living tissue. That was a while ago. But that was not directly the reason why I got into it. So when I closed my dance school, when we had the first lockdown, I had some time to research what was going on. And right away, I saw a lot of very unscientific measures and decisions taking place in politics. And then I dig deeper. And I found what I now call the biggest fraud in scientific history.
When did you begin to realize that perhaps we were not being told the truth when it came to COVID-19 infection rates, as well as the lethality of the virus?
So when I started finding out, I was skeptical from the start, but I gave the authorities and institutions the benefit of the doubt. Okay, if something dangerous is happening, then we can give them some margin of appreciation in how to handle a crisis or a pandemic. But right from the start, one of the things that struck me is that there was no advice on how to stay healthy. It was only directed on safety instead of health. And that was already from the start a very strange perspective when we're talking about health, but not addressing health itself. Another one was the lockdown. There was a lockdown, but still the airspace was open and you could fly anywhere. That doesn't make any sense if you think about containing or mitigating any pathogen. So right from the start, that made no sense at all. And then we started digging deeper and found that almost all the restrictions and measures that have been taken were suddenly changed in the second half of 2019, whereas normally they were based on science. And for instance, lockdown or social distancing was seen as unproven and very dangerous for the social the social ramifications of it, suddenly became something that government should try. And there was no debate about the legality of it, but more importantly, there was no scientific basis at all.
Before we get into the court cases that you have been involved with, as well as your organization, can you provide us with some context here and explain to us how the Dutch government handled this crisis?
It was a flip-flop policy. And what I mean with that, we saw some countries taking a stance. And then I would like to point out towards maybe three countries specifically. So Spain called out the state of emergency and they installed martial law. You had police in the streets. Then Czech Republic closed their borders. Sweden said, we will not go to containment. We will only mitigate, trying to slow down the spread of the disease. And those were very clear policies. And at that time, because the public was not aware of the real facts, you couldn't say which one was better than the other. But what we saw happening in Holland was going from containment to mitigation to lockdown, but then a smart lockdown. So it made no sense at all. Moreover, first, the prime minister said we have to go for herd immunity. So that's more the Swedish policy. And then suddenly, after one phone call with Merkel, the German Bundeskanzler, we went into lockdown. So it was very clear that we do not have our own policy. It's just in the way it is explained, but we follow the German line.
Can you talk a little bit more about how this impacted your business and your dance studio? And I just have to say briefly here, it's bringing back a lot of memories for me because, as I told you, I was also a dancer. So I know that the arts in general has been really impacted by these lockdowns and these restrictions. Can you talk about how it has impacted you personally?
Yes, of course. So normally I would spend 8 hours dancing. I'm pretty fit and pretty healthy. And now I do that same amount of hours behind Zoom calls, Skype calls, and the computer. So it impacted my health in a negative way, these lockdowns. But I feel that it is my duty and my responsibility to try to bring truth. When I look at arts in general, a lot of people in art are dependent, especially in Europe, on subsidies, on state subsidies. On state handouts. So that makes them not very independent. Now, in my case, I own the location where I teach. So that made me much more dependent and also defiant of these draconian policies. But what you're saying is absolutely right. If you look at the impact it has on all cultural events or venues, then you cannot underestimate the impact, and you cannot deny that this is wittingly or unwittingly a war on culture.
You are working with a group called Virus Truth. Can you talk about this organization and some of your founding principles and values?
Yes, so Virus Truth is about truth, of course, and we operate in three area, so to say. So one is to do a lot of court cases. So I think we are at court case 20, constantly trying to hold the people in government accountable for what we see as a big corruption scandal and a big fraud scandal. But besides that, we also try to inform the public about what is real and how people can help themselves. Because if people get sick, of course, it's never a solution to just stay home and do nothing and wait for it to become worse. No, you can actually self-medicate. And then a third is to activate people. One of the examples is demonstrations. But another one is also trying to engage the public, trying to organize, trying to really get people active in an engaging way, so that they try to inform the people around them and try to help the people around them. So our core values are love, truth, and unity. And our goals are in that sense, to try to get an honest, open, and transparent public debate, especially on the side of the institutions, which we feel have completely broken down and are unable to protect us and our human rights.
More broadly speaking, can you talk about what you are fighting for?
Yes, we're fighting for human values, for what it is, what it means to be human. What have generations before us fought for, have led their lives, have bled, have suffered, have sacrificed? All those lessons and all that strife has given us a unique set of rules that is still under development, and the universal human rights, which really shows that we can achieve so much with the whole of humanity. We can be the species that goes up to other planets and will colonize other solar systems, but we have to solve this first. If we do not solve this to stay true to our own values, then I think we do not deserve to go out in the universe.
I do want to now discuss the court cases that you have been involved with, and I want to specifically focus on your case challenging the curfew in Holland. Can you talk about what the results were?
Yes. So for the first time after the Second World War, a curfew was installed in Holland, and that was seen as a very draconian measure, even more than the already draconian lockdown. Especially the youth didn't take very well to it. And then, of course, there was, as with all restrictions, absolutely no scientific basis. So we effectively fought this curfew in court, and we found a judge that had a fair ruling. Now, what happened then is something for movies. Within 4 hours, the state forced the court system into not only getting them a speed appeal, but in that speed appeal, they were granted an injunction. So we had to be back in court after the verdict within 4 hours. And that means that that is an absolute disgrace if you look at due process, if you look at the rules around proper court cases. So what we saw there was a complete breakdown of the court system in Holland. What was even more important, that this was broadcasted. I think a few million people have seen this court case and have seen the absolute corruption within the court system, that these people are not judges, but they're lackeys of the regime. They even had the audacity to tell in the injunction, we have to finish up before 9 because the curfew has to stay in place. So within the hearing, they already gave actually the verdict that they would hold. But it went even further. The judges said, because we have an exemption form, but the rest of the people don't have an exemption form, so this is why we have to finish before 9, which is a slap in the face to everybody, to every law-abiding citizen, I would say.
How did the public react to this?
The public reacted with a lot of dismay and a lot of irony. Everybody could see that this has nothing to do with judgment. This has nothing to do with law. This has nothing to do with rights. This is just people carrying out orders for the regime.
There was also another significant case that you were involved with that was dealing with vaccines. Can you explain to us your progress?
Yes. At the moment, I'm doing the preparation because tomorrow we have the appeal case for that case. So what we specifically demanded of the government is that they have complete and fair information about what they call vaccines, what we call gene therapy. Now, I think it is really important that we acknowledge that we have certain rights, and that is about the bodily integrity, that is about informed consent, and that is about medical privacy. And especially those three areas, we see this information campaign trying to coerce and trying to fool people into participating in a medical experiment, because these injections, I refuse to call them vaccines, these injections are not FDA approved, are not EMA approved. These are experimental substances which are classified as gene therapy.
But are you filing cases against doctors and hospitals?
Yes, we are. And this is the next step, because we see a breakdown in the legal system with these judges that write verdicts which are against the law and in favor of the regime. We're actually filing personal charges against these judges. But it doesn't stop there. We have started filing also personal cases against hospitals and against doctors. And then you have to think about four subjects. So that is gross negligence, that is mistreatment through misdiagnosis, that is refusal of treatment, and that is coercing or forcing people to participate in a medical experiment. And based on those four cases, we will select some doctors that we will try to make an example of. And this is also a lead up to what we think has to happen, and that is the Nuremberg Tribunal revisited, the 2.0, you could say. What was so significant in these trials is that these trials have led to the codification of Nuremberg, or the Nuremberg Code, in which the rules around medical experiments are very carefully drafted. And that has led to numerous legal frameworks, so like the Treaty of Helsinki, the Oviedo Convention, the Treaty of Human Rights in New York. So the code is enormously important for all medical functioning, I would say. And what we have seen in the Nuremberg trials is that a lot of doctors did not get away with the excuse that they were following orders or that they didn't know better. And we are now actually in a very similar state, that doctors are receiving a lot of money, are ignoring facts, and are actually playing the naive person. But what we already saw in the first hearing is that the state already admitted the responsibility for informed consent lies not with the state. So these doctors have already been thrown under the bus, so to say, by the state. They will not take responsibility for misinformation.
Your efforts have been successful, and specifically with regard to police brutality. I remember when we were talking, you said that the police started to back off because there were videos coming out a few months ago that showed what looked like almost a medieval style raid. Can you talk about your successes?
Yes. So what we are doing from the start, because this police brutality started in May last year, so we're a year further now. Then when we had our first demonstration as Virus Truth, our organization, that was on the 21st of June. And then we saw large-scale infiltration police brutality that we have never seen before in Holland. We saw undercover officers trying to incite violence, and trying to bait people into fighting back. Now, what was so significant is that a lot of people filmed all of this. And then the second step was on the 20th of August, where we clearly saw a van driving up, a police vehicle. 10 thugs with masks and clubs jumped out and started hitting people which were sitting on the ground, peacefully protesting. Well, that is an absolute no-go. They were not recognizable as police officers, yet they were. They didn't give any warning, and they were using violence against peaceful protesters. Now, of course, this went viral, and we forced the mayor in an event later on, because we saw this pattern constantly continuing. As soon as masses were reaching a critical point, and that is around 10,000 people, we saw this enormous police brutality. So every 2 months it was building up again, and then you saw this this medieval style of clubbing people until they were lifeless on the ground. So we were very lucky that nobody has died yet, but a lot of people were very severely injured, with head wounds, with broken ribs, with punctured lungs. So we are pressing charges against these police officers individually. But what has to be very clear is that this is not badly trained police. This is what we can best describe as brown shirts. This is an intimidation tactic which is coming from the highest level of government. These people are instructed to incite violence, to intimidate, and that is one of the goals what we are trying to achieve with filing charges against individual officers, so they give up the names of the people that have given these orders, because we suspect, we have reason to suspect, this goes all the way up to the Minister of Justice.
Okay, that is quite incredible, really. I have seen you in the mainstream media. You have received quite a bit of coverage for the work that you're doing. Do you think that the media has been fair to you in its representations of your efforts?
Absolutely not. So what the media does is to legitimize the regime, to facilitate the restrictions, but also to ridicule the people that are critical of this regime. And as one of the spokespeople for the critical movement against the restrictions and the lockdowns, I have been ridiculed, but also demonized. I have had attackers at my school trying to physically assault me. So it is a dangerous and slippery slope the media is going, and I'm generalizing. Of course, there are still journalists that try to be fair and balanced, but what we see more and more is that these journalists cannot get their pieces published. There is a narrative that has to be upheld. Now, the narrative concerning people that are critical is in the following order: extreme right, anti-Semite, racist, terrorist, and conspiracy lunatics. And this is, without exception, a protocol that is being rolled out by all the old media, as I call them, which are normally known as the mainstream, but getting less and less mainstream. So everywhere you go, it's the same arguments. Now, I really believe in speaking out and really exercise your right of freedom of expression and freedom of opinion. And we do see a shift within the police, that they have stopped the police brutality starting from the 1st of April, but also a shift around the 1st of May in the media is that they are now constantly covering more and more, for instance, about aerosols, for instance, about the lab-made origin of the virus, for instance, about the lethality of the injections. So we are seeing a more fair coverage of the subjects, but I cannot call it fair yet. It is now 80-20, where it used to be 95.5%. And that same goes to people like me who are very critical about the regime.
Now, you have also been targeted in a pretty significant way for this work. Can you talk about your arrest and case?
Yes. So I was arrested two times. One of those occasions, they are filing charges of sedition, which is, of course, absurd. So when that case came about, I made very clear and very sure that we had a lot of media attention there. Now, what the public prosecutor tried to do is to set an example. Be careful if you go up against the regime, because we will crush you. And we are not intimidated by these kind of tactics. So we made very clear and very sure that our case was strong. And I filed charges against the public prosecutor because they have committed fraud in this case, which was to be expected, because if you make false charges, yes, then you might be able to get an indictment or to get a verdict. And they are still pursuing the case, but at least the judge ruling about this case has allowed us to call for witnesses. And that makes it almost 100% sure that they will not get any conviction, because now we can hear people. So we want to also hear the mayor, which has ordered the immediate stoppage of the demonstration that we were taking part of, but that was not allowed. And that already shows that they are on very thin ice, because from the papers we see that only the mayor can order a stop to a demonstration, but the demonstration was stopped by a public prosecutor, which is fraud. And not only that, it is a breaking of the law. And as a civil servant, you're held to higher standards, especially when you're a public prosecutor. So we're turning the tables. And this is like a boxing match. You try to feint so the other or your opponent overreaches. And that's when they are weak. So we're not letting go of this case. We're filing cases against them personally. So like with the judges and with the doctors, we also have to take these people to court and to hold them accountable for their crimes. These are all examples of the strong arm of the regime. This is what I think President Truman has mentioned in his speech about the military-industrial complex. We're seeing such a cartel acting here as well, but now it's much more the media, big tech, big pharma, political complex. It's not so much about oil, guns, and steel as it is about control, surveillance, and information.
It's not really about health, is it?
It is absolutely not about health, because if you talk about health, you talk about immune systems, you talk about healthy living, you talk about social well-being, and all of those subjects are non-subjects in this crisis.
What has been the public's reaction to the work that you're doing?
It's mixed, because a lot of people believe the narrative of what the state broadcasts are pushing out. So that propaganda is working to some extent. But on the other hand, a lot of people are getting more and more aware, so that they see that what is brought to them as the truth or the narrative is a fake story. So there is some polarization of the people who are really in favor of the work that we are doing and the people that are really against it. And to try to avoid this, but that's not an easy job, is not to retaliate, is not to scare people into fearing the government or to fearing the vaccines, but to constantly come back to the nuanced scientific debate, to come back to the debate on ethics, to point out the flaws in the logic, to point out the false dilemmas. There is no quick fix and there is no shortcut in truth and in awareness. We are not fighting a regime. We are fighting for humanity in a sense that if we do not raise the awareness, we cannot expect people to act and to behave responsible.
Do people recognize you when you go out now?
Always, yes, without exception. It is, I guess, the status of a famous person. And what is funny about it is that if you look at social media, there's a lot of shadow banning, so my accounts are not that big, in the tens of thousands. But then if I look at the impact that we had in the street, I cannot go out without being recognized. And also the narrative in the media is almost as if I'm a criminal or a terrorist. But then what I meet in the street is a lot of friendly, happy people, very thankful of me, wanting to take pictures. So it is almost a schizophrenic experience, the media narrative and the reality that I get from going out in the street.
You mentioned being obviously arrested. You're clearly targeted and you're also being smeared in the media. Some people may be wondering why continue to do this work.
Yeah, if it was only for the money and the fame, I would never have started this. We make absolutely no money with this. And the fame is something that I was already used to because I was flying around the world performing everywhere with my dancing. So that is not something that I'm still actively pursuing in life. But I will use that status to fight for humanity and to fight for human rights, to fight for human dignity. What is happening now is nothing short of reprogramming humankind from a tribe society. And what I mean with that is that if we look at it biologically speaking, we can compare us to wolves, elephants, dolphins, hyenas, which have a tribal superfamily, very complex social structures, and we are being reprogrammed into herd mentality, comparable to cattle or sheep. And this is something that I cannot allow and that I cannot condone.
What would you say to others who are watching right now who are feeling inspired by the work that you are doing and they want to also make a difference?
What I think is really important is to start doing, to live your life according to your values. And with that, you're already part of the resistance. Don't wait for the savior. Don't wait for the plan to be perfect. Don't think you have to avoid smear campaigns or framing. By doing it, you will find opposition. By doing it, you will be smeared, but see it as a proof of being or going in the right direction. If nobody is noticing you, you're still in stage one. Then you're being ignored. Then stage two is being ridiculed. Stage three is being demonized. Stage four is being rumored. And then stage five, hopefully it won't happen to a lot of us, is being assassinated. Now, of course, when you are part of the resistance, it is not without a price. You will lose friends. You might lose your job. You will be mocked and smeared. You might even have assaults on your property or your life. But I still think this is a small price to pay for our freedom. Freedom in my life or in my lifetime was always a vague concept until it was not. And I realized that this is the defining moment, but also life without freedom is not worth living. And then you can think of, yeah, but maybe I lose my job, so I will keep my head down. If you keep your head down, you will not only lose your job, you will lose your livelihood, you will lose your social life, you will lose your dignity, you will lose everything that makes life worth living.
How can people get involved or help?
By speaking your truth, you make yourself visible. And yes, of course, also visible for the people who are against you. But those are a mere distraction. What I mean is, if you start speaking yourself out, you will start attracting people that are like-minded, that agree with you, that want to act, that want to fight for their life, their freedom, human values. And by doing so, you create communities. And those communities interlink with other communities. And this is the bottom-up, the grassroots movement that we need to go against this network of corruption, the basis of everything, and that is love. Embodying love sounds like something for romantic movies or pop songs, but now it has gotten a whole different meaning. Love is the force that binds people together, that holds society whole. And it also means that if we do not act out of love, we will not succeed. If we are only fighting against the thing that we don't want, we will stay in a perpetual war of attrition. The other side can't win because they do not carry any real values. But we can lose. And how we lose is to lose ourselves. So if we constantly come back to that, I would say almost universal source, that capacity to let go of the borders between your ego and the outside, because that is my technical definition of love, then we cannot overcome. So in a very practical sense, what that means is that people need to accept their feelings. And by accepting all those feelings, you restore self-love. And if you have enough self-love, and only from that point, you can truly love other people, regardless of race, sex, ethnicity, whatever. And with that, you make a real connection. So, number one, and this is the four-step system that I try to give everybody, love yourself. Number two, take care of your family. Number three is form communities. Number four is link those communities and organize. And if we keep doing this, constantly starting from point four, from point one, then going to point four, and repeat. We keep repeating this cycle until we win.
This has been a really inspirational and moving discussion. Willem Engel, thank you.
Thank you very much, Taylor.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you all for watching this video. As I always say, please share it on your social media and don't forget to share it with your friends and your family, because this is a perspective on the COVID-19 crisis that is heavily suppressed in the mainstream news. And if you want to keep up to date with Willem's efforts, you can follow him on social media. We will, of course, continue to keep you updated. So please make sure that you are subscribed to The Last American Vagabond. And I hope that you do feel a little bit more motivated and inspired after watching this interview. So again, I want to thank you guys for watching. I'm independent journalist Taylor Hudak, and I'll see you in the next video.